Cheers.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the International Space Station was just three small rooms when the first crew moved in. The crew members soon discovered there was hardly any space for them to move around. The air was warm and humid, making them feel sticky. 20 years and 241 visitors later, the space station has a lookout tower, enough space for 6 people to sleep, and 12 rooms, depending on how you count. Monday marked 20 years since people first began living on the space station. Astronauts from 19 countries have spent time there. That includes repeat visitors who arrived on spacecraft for short-term repair or building projects, and several tourists who paid their own way. The first crew, American Bill Shepard and Russians Sergei Krikalev and Yuri Gidzenko, left Earth on October 31st, 2000. 2 days later, they opened the doors to the space station, holding hands in a sign of unity. Bill Shepard was the space station's first commander. He likened his time living there to living on a ship at sea. The three-man crew spent most of their time trying to get the equipment to work. Heat from some of the devices made the living space too warm. Adding machinery and making repairs took hours compared to minutes on the ground, Krikalev remembered. Each day seemed to have its own set of challenges, Shepard said during a recent panel discussion with his former crewmates. Their reunion was organized by NASA, the U.S. space agency. Today, the space station is almost as large as a football field and has 3 modern laboratories. The station has enough solar power equipment to fill almost 4/10 of a hectare and enough electrical wiring to stretch 13 kilometers. Shepard is long retired from NASA and lives in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Krikalev and Gidzenko continue to work for the Russian Space Agency. The two were involved in the launch of the space station's 64th crew last month. The first thing the first crew did upon arriving at the darkened space station on November 2, 2000, was turn on the lights, which Krikalev recalled as very memorable. Then they heated water for hot drinks and activated the lone toilet. "Now we can live," Gidzenko remembers Shepard saying. "We have lights, we have hot water, and we have a toilet." The space station did not come close to hitting any space objects during their nearly 5 months up there, Shepard said. And the station has held up relatively well. Today, NASA's top concern is the growing threat from space junk. This year, the space station has had to move around objects 3 times. As for life on the space station, Astronauts now have near-continuous communication with flight controllers and even an internet phone for personal use. The first crew had periodic radio contact with the ground. Communication problems could last hours. Astronauts spend most of their six-month stints these days keeping the space station running and performing science experiments. A few have even spent close to a year up there on a single flight. It takes only 90 minutes for the station to circle the world, giving crew members a chance to enjoy 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets each day. While more men have served on the space station than women, more crews today are likely to include women. Two U.S. women have served as the space station's commander. Commanders usually are American or Russian, but have also come from Belgium, Germany, Italy, Canada, and Japan. Monday was a major anniversary for the International Space Station. But the space station has, in fact, spent 22 years in Earth's orbit, and its first piece was launched into space in 1998. NASA and its partners say the space station easily has several years of usefulness left. Russia's Mir station operated for 15 years in the late 1980s and 1990s. America's 1970s Skylab spent much less time in space, as did China's much more recent orbital missions. Shepard said that the past 20 years of international experience and cooperation can help massive projects, like possibly sending humans to the planet Mars. If you look at the space station program today, it's a blueprint on how to do it, Shepard said. All those questions about how this should be organized and what it's going to look like, the big questions, are already behind us.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. If you asked me to name the top life lessons of 2020, my list would likely include these words: technology skills are a necessity. For the past 8 months, many people have been working online from home. This kind of work requires a higher level of computer skills than ever before. Now there is even a term for it: digital upskilling. Patricia Miller works for PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, in Tampa, Florida. She signed up for the company's Digital Accelerators program. The training is designed to strengthen the high-tech skills of PwC's workforce. Miller told Reuters News Agency that before taking the class, she did not know how to write computer code. The program helped Miller to upgrade her digital skills. For example, she learned a coding language called Python. Miller once worked in human resource and project management. The training helped her to become a leader in the office's information technology operations team. And now, every time I get to use my coding skills, like Python, Miller said, I do a little happy dance. Digital upskilling is not new. However, the COVID-19 health crisis has led to big changes and made this happen even faster. Gianni Giacomelli is Chief Innovation Officer at Genpak, a New York-based business that advises companies on business operations. He also is Head of Innovation Design at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Collective Intelligence Design Lab. Giacomelli says that since the COVID-19 pandemic started, many businesses have been fast-tracking their use of digital technologies. They are enabling people to learn wherever they are, whenever they want, on any device, he noted. A company can be more successful or earn higher profits if their employees are up to speed on the latest technologies. But what tech skills are we talking about? This past summer, the career website LinkedIn looked at job openings for in-demand work-related skills. Most of the skills were technology-related. Working with Microsoft, LinkedIn has set up free training for in-demand jobs. These include positions as a computer software developer, digital marketing representative, and IT administrator. But it is not just the technology industry that must digital upscale. Before, there used to be tech jobs and non-tech jobs. Now, there are just jobs, said Joe Atkinson. He is PwC's Chief Products and Technology Officer. He added that everyone needs to be at ease when using technology. Experts offer a few suggestions on how companies should support digital upskilling. However, these guidelines can also be helpful for individuals and families. Think small. For many people, learning does not get done because the work can seem so massive, even frightening. Breaking larger learning goals into smaller tasks or projects can help. If you ask an employee to find 6 hours for a learning effort, that's really hard, said Atkinson. But if you ask them to find 15 minutes, that's a lot easier. He calls it a bite-size approach, and he thinks it can make a big difference. Think as a group. For some businesses, having an employee learn a digital skill alone on a computer might be a good idea. However, it may not help the company as a whole. Instead, Genpak's Giacomelli suggests that companies think about the whole company and how employees interact with each other. Create opportunities for employees to source knowledge and learn from each other, he said. This idea can be likened to how many families operate. Does someone in the family have knowledge the others do not? Create a way to share it. Create an ongoing learning habit. Technology can change very quickly. For example, the coding language Patricia Miller learned, Python, might be out of date in a few years. So experts urge you to find ways to always keep learning and improving your technology skills. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On a cold and cloudy day in March of 1861, Abraham Lincoln became the 16th President of the United States. In his inaugural speech, the new president announced the policy that he would follow toward the southern states that had left the Union. Lincoln said, no state had a legal right to secede. The Union could not be broken. He said he would enforce federal laws in every state. And he promised not to surrender any federal property in the states that seceded. Lincoln said if force was necessary to protect the Union, then force would be used. His policy was soon tested. Jack Weitzel and Jack Moyles discuss the dispute over the federal base that was being built at Fort Sumter.
On his second day as president, Lincoln received some bad news from Fort Sumter at Charleston, South Carolina. Major Robert Anderson, the commander of the small United States force at Sumter, wrote that his food supplies were low. At most, said Anderson, there was enough food for 40 days. Unless he and his men received more supplies, they would have to leave the fort. Lincoln wanted to keep Fort Sumter. It was one of the few United States forts in the South still held by federal forces, and he had promised not to give up any federal property in the states that seceded.
But getting food to Fort Sumter would be a very difficult job. The fort was built on an island in Charleston Harbor. It was surrounded by southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the port. To get supplies to Anderson and his men, a ship would have to fight its way to Sumter. Such a battle was sure to begin a bitter civil war. There also was the danger that fighting would cause slave states still in the Union to secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
The Army Chief, General Scott, warned Lincoln that it was too late to get supplies to Fort Sumter. He said southern defenses around the fort were so strong that a major military effort would be necessary. He said it would take months to prepare the warships and soldiers for such an effort. Major Anderson and his men at Sumter, he said, could not wait that long. There was another plan, however, that might work. It was proposed to Lincoln by Captain Gustavus Fox of the Navy Department. Captain Fox said soldiers and supplies could be sent down to Charleston in ships. Outside the entrance to the harbor, on a dark night, they could be put into small boats and pulled by tugs to the fort. Fox said a few warships could be sent to prevent southern gunboats from interfering.
Lincoln liked this plan, he asked his cabinet for advice. If it were possible to send supplies to Sumter, he asked, would it be wise to do so? Postmaster General Blair was the only member of the cabinet to answer yes. Treasury Secretary Chase was for the plan only if Lincoln was sure it would not mean war. Secretary of State Seward and the others opposed it. They said it would be better to withdraw Major Anderson and his men. They felt that now was not the time to start a civil war. This opposition in the cabinet caused Lincoln to postpone action on the Fox Plan. But he sent two men separately to Charleston to get him information on the situation there. One was Captain Fox. The other was a close friend, Ward Lamon.
In Charleston, Fox met with Governor Pickens. He explained that he wished to talk with Major Anderson, not to give him orders, but to find out what the situation really was. Governor Pickens agreed. A Confederate boat carried Fox to Sumter. Anderson told Fox that the last of the food would be gone on April 15th. Ward Lamon went to Charleston after Fox returned to Washington. He, too, met with Governor Pickens and Major Anderson. The South Carolina governor asked Lamon to give Lincoln this message. Nothing can prevent war except a decision by the President of the United States to accept the secession of the South. If an attempt is made to put more men in Fort Sumter, a war cry will be sounded from every hilltop and valley in the South. Lamon reported to Lincoln that the arrival of even a boatload of food at Sumter would lead to fighting.
At the end of March, Lincoln held another cabinet meeting and again asked what should be done about Fort Sumter. Should an attempt be made to get supplies to Major Anderson? This time, three members of the cabinet voted yes and three voted no. When the meeting ended, Lincoln wrote an order for the Secretary of War. He told him to prepare to move men and supplies by sea to Fort Sumter. He said they should be ready to sail as early as April 6th, only 1 week away.
On April 4th, Lincoln called Captain Fox to the White House. He told him that the government was ready to take supplies to Fort Sumter. He said Fox would lead the attempt. Lincoln showed Fox a message he was sending to Governor Pickens in South Carolina. It read, "This is to inform you that an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with food only. If this attempt is not opposed, no effort will be made to throw in men, arms, or ammunition." Governor Pickens received the message on April 8th. He immediately sent it by telegraph to Confederate President Jefferson Davis at Montgomery, Alabama. Davis called a meeting of his cabinet to discuss what should be done. He asked if Fort Sumter should be seized before supplies could arrive.
Former United States Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia was the Confederate Secretary of State. He told Davis, "Firing upon that fort will begin a civil war greater than any the world has ever seen. I cannot advise you." Later in the meeting, Toombs urged Davis not to attack the fort. "Mr. President," he said, At this time, it is suicide, murder, and will lose us every friend in the North. You will strike a hornet's nest which extends from mountains to oceans. Millions now quiet will swarm out and sting us to death. It is not necessary. It puts us in the wrong. It will kill us.
On April 10th, Jefferson Davis sent his decision to the Confederate commander at Charleston, General Pierre Beauregard. He told Beauregard to demand the surrender of Fort Sumter. If Major Anderson refused, then the general was to destroy the fort. The surrender demand was carried to Sumter the next day by a group of Confederate officers. They said Anderson and his men must leave the fort, but they could take with them their weapons and property. And they were offered transportation to any United States port they named.
Anderson rejected the demand. As he walked with the Confederate officers back to their boat, he asked if General Beauregard would open fire on Sumter immediately. No, they said. He would be told later when the shooting would start. Anderson then told the Southerners, "If you do not shell us to pieces, hunger will force us out in a few days." General Beauregard informed the Confederate government in Montgomery that Anderson refused to surrender. He also reported the major's statement that Sumter had only enough food for a few more days.
New orders were sent to Beauregard. Jefferson Davis said there was no need to attack the fort if hunger would soon force the United States soldiers to leave. But he said Anderson must say exactly when he and his men would leave. And he said Anderson must promise not to fire on Confederate forces. If Anderson agreed to this, then Confederate guns would remain silent. This offer was carried to Fort Sumter a few minutes before midnight, April 11th. Anderson discussed the offer with his officers and then wrote his answer. He would leave the fort on April 15th if the Confederates made no hostile act against Fort Sumter or against the United States flag. He would not leave, however, if before then he received new orders or supplies.
This did not satisfy the three Confederate officers who brought Beauregard's message. They handed Anderson a short note. It said, "We have the honor to inform you that General Beauregard will open fire on Fort Sumter in 1 hour, at 4:20, on the morning of April 12, 1861. The major shook hands with Beauregard's representatives, and they left the fort. Anderson and his officers woke their men and told them to prepare for battle. At Fort Johnson, across the harbor, Confederate gunners also were getting ready. These men would fire the first shot at Sumter. That explosion would signal the other guns surrounding the fort to open fire.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.